as we celebrate Palm Sunday, but the church's tradition has also allowed for the celebration of Passion Sunday. And I thought it interesting, and I introduced this with the children, that there are a lot of obscure names of people that just don't ring a bell for any of us that are first century governors of Judea. But as soon as you throw Pontius Pilate, my guess would be most of you, if not all of you out here in the congregation, immediately knew that we were dealing with some kind of political force or political rulers in the time of Jesus, whether you narrowed it down to first century governors of Judea or not. This is Pilate and his authority. He was a minor official that would have gone down in history pretty much as a forgotten name if it weren't for this trial. And now his name's known around the world. Every time the church pronounces the creed, we say, "Suffered under Pontius Pilate." So that as much as he attempted to wash his hands of the guilt of this, his name is forever ensconced in the very creeds that we speak. Now, I'm sure Pilate had to be mystified that morning. He wasn't expecting anything like this as the high priest and the elders spill into his chambers and they demand that this bound prisoner before him named Jesus be dealt with by the governing powers. Jesus had been accused by them of blasphemy. But you know, Roman governors have no concern for religious squabbles. They are not interested in any charge of blasphemy. That's a religious squabble. And so they come to Pilate with a better accusation, one they know that holds some force, and that is, he says he's king of the Jews. And now we're talking possible politics. And this is where Pilate asks the question in verse 11, the only question that matters to Pilate, not "Are you a blasphemer?" Not "Are you Messiah?" Who cares? For Pilate, the only question that matters is, do you claim to be king of the Jews? Because that was Herod's title. That was Herod's authority. This was Pilate's way of saying, are you a revolutionary? Are you a terrorist? Are you one that's out to take out Roman stability and lead a resistance movement in such a way that the power of Rome needs to put you under our thumb and get rid of you in a way that shows anyone else they better not resist Roman authority? So that's his only concern, and that's why Jesus gives that ambiguous answer, "You say so." Because he neither confirms that he's king of the Jews or denies it. Because he can't say, well, yes and no. Because no, he's not king of the Jews by means of a violent terrorist, someone who's going to lead a resistance movement against Rome. But yet he is coming as one who says, "I'm the son of David, the rightful king of the Jews." So he can't answer Pilate in any way, and so he simply gives that ambiguous answer, "You say so." And in verse 12, all of the sudden, all of the religious accusers start piping up because his answer's not firm enough, and they start to shout and declare their accusations again. And that's when in verse 13, Pilate says, "Don't you hear how many accusations they make against you?" But verse 14, he gives no answer, not even to a single charge. So that Pilate is greatly amazed. Pilate doesn't know what to make of this. Jesus won't defend himself. Jesus faces a possible death penalty, and he should be, if he were like you and I, cowering in fear. At the very least, but Jesus is quietly composed. He won't utter a word. So what do you do when your defendant won't plead guilty? They won't assert their innocence? They won't deny the charges? And what do you do when you feel, as Pilate must have felt initially early on, that Jesus is innocent? Because it's interesting, verse 18, he realized it was out of jealousy they'd handed him over. Pilate was aware, he knew the machinations of politics, he knew that these religious authorities were envious of Jesus' popularity. So in his mind, he understands Jesus probably not at fault here, and so he is in a situation where they're demanding action, and he doesn't want to have to act on their action. He doesn't want to be their pawn, and you can guess the reason for that. He's the one in charge. And so refusing to be their pawn, Pilate comes up with a very shrewd plan. And I love his shrewdness. Because he's going to try, if possible, to release Jesus. But not by making the choice himself. He's going to make the people make the choice. So he's going to try to remove himself from the decision and allow the people to liberate Jesus rather than him. And that's why at verse 15 we get that custom of the Passover pardon. It lay within the governor's power to liberate a prisoner, particularly on Passover. Think of it. Passover is about the liberation of Israel from Egyptian oppression. So as a show of Rome's goodwill, there could be this liberation of one prisoner during the time of Passover. And it's a shrewd move because he's going to liberate one, but he still gets to crucify a lot of others. So it's not like in this giving away of someone, crucifixion won't happen. People are going to die, but this allows them to have a little bit of a choice in the matter. He's doing his best to decide not to decide. So he's working the crowd like every politician does. He's manipulating. He's scheming. He knows how he'd like this thing to come out. And so he offers them the worst possible option. He says, here's Jesus Barabbas. And in the day, Jesus was a common name, Yeshua. It was a very common name. And so we have a Jesus, he's Barabbas. And Barabbas means literally son of the father. And you can make it out, Abba, Abbas, father, Bar is son of. This is the other Jesus who's the son of the father. And this Jesus who is the son of the father is notorious in verse 16, which is a Greek word that isn't necessarily negative. It means he's prominent. He's well known. He's famous. He's public enemy number one. And he's known widely for his resistance actions against Rome. He's murdered. He's terrorized. He's violent. He is a man that the people would see as a very, very violent man. And so Pilate says, here's your choice. Shall I release, verse 17, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus the Messiah? Barabbas the robber and murderer or Jesus who obviously has done nothing wrong? And he thinks the choice should be obvious. He's convinced the crowd will opt for Jesus, in my mind, because he knows that Jesus is popular with the crowds. He knows the priests and elders have brought him because they are jealous of his popularity. And before the crowd makes their choice, in verse 19, there's an interesting parenthesis because the question is kind of put on hold. Which will you choose? And all of a sudden, a person comes in and they say, I have a report for you. Your wife has had this terrifying dream and she has essentially said, have nothing to do with this innocent man. I've suffered greatly in a dream. Now, dreams matter. Particularly for Romans. They took their dreams with great seriousness. Dreams matter in the book of Matthew. Joseph is told what to do in Matthew 1 and 2 by dreams. So the dreams are a portent of revelation. They are a way to understand there may be more going on subconsciously than we recognize. And maybe you ought to think twice about this, Pilate. So his wife warns him. Meanwhile, in verse 20, we see the chief priest and the elders swaying the crowd, saying, don't pick Jesus, pick Barabbas. And we all know that crowds are easily swayed. So that when we finally get time for the answer, the question to be answered, in verse 21, the governor says to them, which of the two do you want me to release? Three times there will be rejection. First is, we want Barabbas at the end of verse 21. And Pilate starts to panic. What will I do with Jesus, who's called the Messiah? And the answer is, let him be crucified. And then Pilate, in desperation, verse 23, says, why? What evil has he done? And instead of there being a defense, a sense of, well, here's the evil he's done, the crowd's screams intensify, and when mobs rule and they become bloodthirsty, you don't need reasons anymore. You just simply say, let him be crucified! And three times the crowd says it until Pilate says or realizes he can do nothing. And I love verse 24 because it's not really true. So when Pilate saw that he could do nothing, don't forget, he's the Roman governor. He's in charge. He's the one that is in control. He's decided in his mind that he's going to have to crack a few eggs to make this omelet. And even though he doesn't think it's just or right to crucify Jesus, he's going to have to go with the sway of the crowd because he's not really concerned about Messiahs. He's just concerned with keeping the peace. He just wants to make sure there's not a riot. Who cares who gets crucified in the end? People still are going to get crucified. And so when he saw verse 24, he could do nothing, but a riot was beginning. He takes some water and he washes his hands in a desperate attempt to proclaim, like most politicians are willing to say, the buck doesn't stop here. I'll pass the buck. This isn't my fault. I'm not to blame. I am not guilty. But as we recognize in many politicians' actions, those hollow gestures don't take away complicity. Because Jesus can't go to the cross unless Pilate gives the command. So he's unable to wipe away the blood as much as he'd like to, and he goes down in infamy as being preserved forever in our creed, Pontius Pilate, under whom Christ suffered. Now, even under all this pressure, Pilate still had power, and that's why I said verse 24 is not quite true. He could have done something. He could have taken his wife's advice. He could have called about a dozen or so soldiers and exercised his authority and dispersed the mob. There were a number of options open to him, but he caved to public pressure because in the end, he wasn't concerned about justice. He wasn't concerned about right or wrong. He wasn't concerned with their religious squabbles. The only thing he was concerned was to get this squabble out of his head and out of his way. And so he cracks an egg to make an omelet. He achieves his goal. The threat is diminished. He avoids a riot. He secures his position. He proves to be a very shrewd politician. Meanwhile, the crowd in verse 25 give that exclamation, "His blood be on us." And the thing we must be always careful with, particularly in light of last century's history, is that verse has been used very sinfully and wrongly to assume that the Jews are only responsible for this. In Matthew's gospel, that's there simply to say, "Barabbas, crucify, crucify." The whole crowd is three times saying, "We want this to happen." Pilate desperately trying to wash away the guilt, and they own it and say, "Well, if you won't wear the blood, we will. We'll take it." And the point is not to say that the Jewish people are to blame for this. It is to say that this is a situation where, as Israel has done again and again, they reject the prophet, they stone the prophet, they run the prophet out of town. But really, it's not just them that's involved in this. The Gentiles, through Pilate, the Romans, are implicit. They're complicit in this, as well as the entire crowd. Well, we come to the final verse there. Verse 26, he releases Barabbas for them. And remember, he doesn't think Jesus has done anything wrong, but he has no problem flogging him. You know, what evil is there in him? Nothing. Well, flog him to death. And the Roman flagellum is brought out, a leather whip that is strewn with bone and bits of metal, and it's meant to shred your back, and it sometimes would kill the person bound for crucifixion before they ever arrived. And then after Jesus survives that flogging, he's handed over for crucifixion. Now that's our text. But the thing that I'd like to do in reflection on our text is simply this. Every year that Passion rolls around, the question that seems to rise in many people's minds is, who does kill Jesus in the end? Who is responsible for his death? And the answer always is, all of us. The Jews aren't singled out as the only ones guilty. Judas is responsible. Peter and the disciples who deny and abandon. Pilate is responsible as a representative of Roman authority and Gentile power. The Roman Empire is responsible for their ugly way of torturing those who went against their authority. The chief priest and the elders, the denominational leaders like me, the people that are in charge that run the religious show. There's not one single group or party or nation or religion guilty, but everyone is complicit in the death, so that there's only one person not guilty in the story of the Passion of the Cross, and it's Jesus. And what that does is it introduces real disturbing reflections on religious authority and political authority and mob mentality. You think about religious authority. Here's chief priests and elders, the Sanhedrin, the 71 most holy men in Jerusalem, considered wise and law-keeping. And we all know religion at its best can inspire and bring hope and be good. But these are the denominational executives that decide it's better for one man to die than for our whole system to be uprooted by his way of thinking. And we begin to realize, like Christopher Hitchens, the noted atheist, said, he said religion poisons everything. that's a little bit too harsh. I'd rather say poison can be hidden within religion without us even knowing it. It can harbor a poison and it can be used in very, very hateful ways. Which is why Pascal in the 16th century said, men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. Men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. But it's not just the religious authorities, it's the political authorities, the state that we all trust in and rely on. The state at its best brings order, it executes justice. But the state can also oppress and crack a few eggs in order to make its own brand of omelet. It can destroy children and bring oppression and bring about the death of innocents because it's concerned about power and maintaining order at all cost. We must never forget that there'd be no cross without the power of the state. So it's not just religious authority, it's not just political authorities, but the crowd then represents all of us. Because let's face it, can anyone or anything cause us to see our choice and sometimes to say, you know, I admire Jesus, but I think I'd feel safer under Barabbas. You know, I admire the way of mercy and justice and submission, but, you know, that way of force and violence and domination really seems to suggest strength. That's why Adam Hamilton, in his study that the Christian Ed people are looking at, has an amazing quote that is very challenging for anyone, wherever you're from and wherever you're at. If you picture yourself as part of that crowd, which one do you pick? One is going to lead by force. They're going to throw out the Romans. They're going to reclaim your tax money, wealth, and prosperity and restore the strength of the Jewish kingdom. They'll make Israel great again. Not to be political, but they're going to be after your interest and making your life great again. The other involves loving these same oppressors and serving those who dwell among you. And I think when given the choice, we find that, you know, Barabbas seems like a good pick. He knows how to get things done. He knows how to bring terror and show power and force and domination. And he seems to have the right idea that we need to be concerned about us first instead of Jesus, who is standing in the way of nonviolence, the way of peace. That's why I think if we really had to make the choice, I think most of us would say we really admire Jesus' way, but the way of Barabbas really seems to work. And because of that, let's crack a few eggs in order to have that good omelet. Now, this is the bad news of the text. I find it amazing that Pilate didn't realize he was also proclaiming good news. Because the good news of this text that's hidden within it, if you're willing to look at the fact that all of us stand condemned, whether in political authority, religious authority, or just being part of the mob mentality of the crowd, that there's there's another name that you wouldn't know of if it weren't for this account. You wouldn't know of Pilate from Marcellus and Marullus. You wouldn't know that name if it weren't for this. You'd never hear of this terrorist. You'd never hear of this one who resists Rome influence, this one called Barabbas, were it not for this. But thank God we've heard of Barabbas, because quite literally, he is the first sinner for whom Jesus dies. Pilate gives in this expression of a Passover choice a literal picture of the salvation that is being wrought in the cross, because when Jesus dies, Barabbas goes free. And Barabbas ends up representing all of us who walk away free because of the suffering of an innocent man. He represents the one who's liberated in this new Passover story, and thus he becomes the first one to show us that Jesus' innocence leads to freedom and salvation. N.T. Wright puts it this way: the human systems that carve up the world between them conspired to put Jesus on the cross. But what happened is Jesus dies in the place of the sinner. His great Passover action makes a way through the Red Sea of sin and death, inviting Barabbas and an increasing multitude ever since to walk through to freedom. So one good news in this text is Barabbas, who does represent us at our worst, goes free, while Jesus, the innocent one, goes to the cross. But the other beautiful thing, which people often fail to see in the midst of this, is we call this Passion Week for a reason. We call it Passion Week not for the reason that many think. We hear passion and we think of emotion, we think of desire. But passion is the Latin way to say that Jesus passively suffers. Most of his ministry is active obedience. He's actively doing things. He does miracles. He multiplies bread. He brings healing. He brings hope. He brings comfort. He's active in people's life, and that's what we really like. We don't like when we're stuck in passive obedience, where all we can do is maintain meekness and patience and trust while we're being acted upon. And we call it the Passion because Jesus is showing absolute integrity in the midst of the sin and wickedness and corruption around him. That he faces all of this with meekness, with self-control. Because at any time he could call down 12 legions of angels and stop this. This is his choice. He faces it with forbearance. He chooses to go with them so that really, we've called this the trial, but you know who's on trial? It's not Jesus. He's the innocent one. He's the only one that's just. It's the religious authorities on trial. It's the political authorities on trial. It is the mob mentality that's on trial. Jesus triumphs over all of that by being obedient to the end. And in his obedience, you see the great failure of the cross. It looks like it's all over, like it's not going to lead to anywhere. It's not right. What does one get from being just and having integrity and walking in the way of God? Well, a cross. But guess what God's choice will be in choosing Barabbas or Jesus? God will vindicate his servant and say, "My choice for the righteous religious authority, the righteous political authority, and the righteous leader of the crowds is the Christ." That he is risen. He is risen indeed. Christ is Lord, and he triumphs through self-giving, suffering love, rather than dominating violence. Will you pray with me?